So you had of the weakness of the protector. Did you voice it to your those that were on the ship?
I think, you know, I don't think I gathered everybody up and said, look, this is, you know, I'm really worried about this. That wouldn't be the thing to do. I mean,
right.
You know, they looked to their captain for the guy that's going to take care of them and do the right thing. And we were doing that. I mean, it was a calculated risk. But there were lots of people in the ship who knew that. In other words, anybody, you know, any of the medium-ranked or higher-ranked NCOs that worked in the operations room, on the bridge, and in a number of other places in the ship, the engineers would know that because they're the ones responsible for the degaussing, as it's called, the demagnetization of the ship. They take care of all that equipment. And when we did the trials and we couldn't demagnetize the ship, that was well known. That night during that 36 hours of trials, I just gave up. I said, look, I've got no more time to waste on this. You're not making it any better by the adjustments you're making, so I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be common knowledge. I don't know if every cook on board knew it, but certainly...
Or the media?
Yeah.
The media?
No, well, of course, you wouldn't... you do not want to,
yeah,
in wartime, expose your deficiencies or weaknesses to the media, that's for sure. So you would never do that.
Right.
Nobody ever does. You know, loose lips sink ships and all that kind of stuff. Those old sayings are true. You do not want... Because the enemy can... Oh, great. You know, all you got to do is get a mine over there and blow this guy up. So, you kept that very close to the chest. But I think that generally the ship's company had a pretty good feeling about, you know, what our vulnerabilities were. And that's why that close-in weapon system, when it didn't work in Terra Nova, was such a demoralizer. Because they knew that that was the one thing that would probably save their ass on an incoming missile. And it's not working right now. And that got through the ship's company right away. Everybody knew, oops, you know, hey, it's not working. And that's why I had to give one, because it was really, really affecting their morale.
Now, with the media, do you think they maybe just didn't... They maybe had an idea, but they, common sense, they didn't report it? Or did you guys really try to keep them out of the loop?
There were... No, it was interestingly, to my surprise, and sometimes concern, my instructions were not, that I was not allowed to censor any of the media... reports. And that was particularly difficult in my position because I carried all the media in Protector, all of them. And they would go over to Terra Nova, or they would go over to Athabasca maybe for a day here and there to do a story over there. But they lived in my ship, which meant they were there 24 hours a day. They were at liberty to get around the ship and go anywhere they wanted, except for the operations room, which is classified, so they couldn't go in there. But they could talk to anybody they wanted to, any of the ship's company, interview them. TV, radio, they did all that. I was told not only was I not to censor anything, but I was to help them get their stories ashore as quickly as possible. So we used our satellite telephones to allow them to make their... satellite telephones were a brand new thing, and we just got them for that trip to help them get their stories back home to wherever they were going to go, to the newspaper or to the radio station or whatever. Likewise, if they were doing a TV thing, you know, we sent take their stuff ashore in a helicopter and send it back to Canada for them. So we were pretty open. There are certain things. I mean, there are some places they couldn't go into the communications rooms and stuff, because that's where all the cryptography takes place. And, you know, there are certain classified spaces that even other members of my ship's company can't go. It's only the people that work there and you know, the officers sort of were involved. So there's some compartmentalization of information, but it's like that every day in every ship. So they have pretty free rein, actually, to get around. And I told them to interview anybody in the ship's company they wanted to. And they were... One of the big thrusts was the whole thing of having women on board, because we were the only ship that did.
Right.
None of the other navies had women in their ships. In some cases, they had women in their ships. They took them off before they sent them there. But we did not. So we were the only ones that had women in our ships. And so that was... I was doing TV radio interviews over the radio with British reporters in British ships that wanted to talk to me about what it's like to have women in a war zone kind of thing. So that was one of the big focuses for the media.
Right.
Another was the you know, a recurring sort of theme was the fact that our ships were old.
Yes.
And you know, we were quite happy to get that coverage, frankly, because the Navy, our new ships were about to build. The fact is, the Navy had been allowed to rust out and atrophy for a long time, which was not the first time that happened. And so, you know, if we saw that as positive support, that if we're going to have a Navy that the Government of Canada is going to task to go up and do things like this, they need to be provided with the proper stuff. And so we saw that as, you know, very positive.
Right.
But as I said, there those two or three things that I was mostly concerned with, I certainly wouldn't tell them. Now, they might have heard it from somebody else, but obviously, I don't remember that ever being reported, so whether they didn't ask the right question or not, I don't know. But I never took anything out of it. I never even saw the stuff they did.
So
I never saw it.
Okay, so you didn't...
Until I got home. Or somebody sent me a say, oh, there's a nice article here about your ship, or whatever. You know, 2 or 3 weeks late, I'd see what it was this guy said, or a woman in some case.
Now, with the... You're going through the Suez Canal. Now you're going... You stopped off at... What was it? Dubai? It was one of the ports before you went to...
Djibouti.
That's it. Sorry. Djibouti. And you kind of felt a culture shock. This was your first Middle Eastern country anyone had gone into, right?
Yeah, in a long time. I mean, I've been to some awful places in the world.
Right.
I hadn't been there before, but I've been to some terribly poor countries with all the inherent problems that they have. So it wasn't a shock from the point of view of the people and their problems. It was a little bit worse in some cases, because Djibouti is an unusual place. It's kind of a city-state. It has no natural resources. Its sole source of income is handouts from the French, because it's a French protectorate, and illegal smuggling of cigarettes and liquor into Saudi Arabia. That's the country's only source of income.
Mm.
So a very, very poor country, that's for sure. And we stopped there because we thought that might be a good forward operating base for us, a supply base. So the thought being that it was only a couple of days steaming from the Gulf around to Djibouti in the Red Sea. And what we were thinking of doing is that we could forward all our have all our aircraft and everything that are bringing stuff from Canada that we needed on a rotating continuous basis. Could bring that into Djibouti, and then I, in particular, would go over there every whatever week or two, pick everything up, bring it back, give it to whoever needs it, keep the rest, and put it in the storerooms, whatever. And that was the general idea. And fuel, they had a fueling facility there, so I could go over there and get more fuel, pay for it, bring it over, give it to the ships. So that was what we were thinking. But we took one look at the place. Once we got there, their fueling system was full of sand, and so it would have ruined the turbines in Athabasca very quickly.
Mm.
Totally. I mean, those are jet engines, so if you put sand in there, you're done. So anyway, we didn't take the fuel. My engineer went out and did due diligence and came back and said, sir, we do not want to take that fuel. These pipes are all full of dirt. So we said, turn off the fuel. Then we were getting a bunch of groceries. They were all crawling with any number of bugs I've never seen before in my life. So that stuff was all pretty much spoiled. So it wasn't going to be a good place for food. And just the general, although the port itself was not too bad in terms of its layout and stuff, but there were other so many problems that this was not going to work out as a good boarding base. So we jagged in that idea. I believe we left early. I think we were supposed to spend a couple days there. We just spent one night and we left and never went back.
And the second place you actually looked at was Dubai, right?
Well, there was a number. There was Dubai. Bahrain was really, the first one, because that's where the Americans were headquartered always, even before the Gulf Crisis. That's where their headquarters, their command ship was homeported. And there were a number of American ships that were there on a continuous basis. So we thought that might be the place. But... And in many ways, we did use Bahrain. We put a group of people ashore there, and we flew a lot of our things into Bahrain, and we could get them down to the ship pretty easily, so out by boat. But the trouble was, I couldn't get an alongside berth there on a regular basis because there's only one jetty at one pier, and the Americans were using it all the time. Mm-hmm. So we needed to go somewhere else where I could, that meaning everything would have to come out by boat. You know, it just adds another layer of difficulty in getting especially bigger things out to the ship. So that's when we said, okay, we looked around at the UAE, seemed like the right place. And once we saw Dubai, and we could have done it in Dubai or Jebel Ali or Abu Dhabi, any of those UAE ports are fantastic. They're modern, they're brand new. They have all the facilities for handling containers, fuel, bulk cargo. They have dry docks in case you needed to do some repairs to your ship. They have everything. I mean, they're spectacular ports. And Dubai was the nearest. And it was a spectacular port. I mean, it's just miles and miles of beautiful, brand new docks and everything. So, and they were very positively disposed towards the coalition for what we were doing. So that was a no-brainer. We ended up using Dubai, and I would go in there regularly. It was only about a 10 or 12 hour journey from my patrol area down there to pick that stuff up, leave the next morning, be back on patrol. So I'd be gone less than 24 hours, I think, if I remember correctly, to get all that stuff. So we got all of our goodies in containers and so on in Dubai. Small amounts of stuff would come through Bahrain because we could. It was right adjacent. It was only spitting distance from my patrol area. So we could get, you know, through small things. We'd get the helicopters in, get that stuff back out to the ship very quickly. Mail, all that sort of thing came to Bahrain. We brought that out by helicopter, so that was good. And then the other thing was fuel. And fuel, initially I was buying it. I got the first load in Bahrain. It was very painful. It took me days to get them to allow me to go into their fueling place and get fuel, for starters. And they were just not flexible. And it took me a week, if I remember correctly, the first step, week of begging to get my ship in there so I could fill up and get back out there and give the ship some more fuel because I was getting low. And that just was way too hard. And so I picked up fuel in a place called Jebel Ali, which is another one of the UAE ports. And that was a beautiful setup there. They have a very, very modern fueling facility. And within a month or so, maybe 2 months of me getting there, the Saudi Arabians said that they would give us free fuel. So, well, we just had to get it. So what happened was the Americans, they were giving it to us in one of their Red Sea ports, which meant it had to come through the Red Sea, around through the Strait of Hormuz, and up into the UAE. So the Americans chartered a couple of merchant ships to bring the fuel around so that I wouldn't have to go get it, because that would take me off patrol continuously. They would bring it around and put it in Jebel Ali, and then I would just go down there and pick it up, and it was free. So I'd pick up $6 or $7 million worth of fuel every couple of weeks and take it out and give it to all the ships. It's free for all the coalition ships.
And you would fill 64 ships in a week, you'd say?
No, I would say how many fuel? We would probably fuel a couple of ships a day, every day.
Okay, so maybe 64 a month, maybe?
Yeah, that'd be about right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I read that somewhere.
It's
pretty impressive.
Yes, as well as doing the other, you know, patrolling, boarding, and all those other flying around helicopters. So.
And when you were in Bahrain, there was actually a couple of issues. One was also because of the missiles that could come from Iraq. Didn't feel very safe, right?
That's correct. They were definitely in the missile shadow there. That you know, that was another consideration about moving our supply place a little bit further south.
And also, the Americans would pretty much take up a lot of the.
You couldn't get in there. I mean, really, there just wasn't any room. They had it all bought up.
The crews as well, though, so.
Yeah.
Now, when you were going through past Yemen, Iran, what did you tell your officers to look out for? Because they were pretty neutral, those two countries, during
this. Well, we weren't so sure, the truth. We didn't trust, you know, frankly, we didn't trust either one of those countries. And I know that when we went past Yemen, we were we have systems in the ship that can detect if you're being radiated by radar, and then you can actually when we went past Yemen, just after we left Djibouti, we were actually illuminated. We detected that they were illuminating us with radars that were associated with anti-ship missiles. So that was the first time that happened. And we all said, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, like, we think you're just doing this to let us know that they know that we're here and all that kind of stuff. So then as we carried on and we were going to go through the Strait of Hormuz, we knew the Iranians had similar capability. Mm-hmm. And so we planned to go through there at night fast. So we'd be in the dark and we'd get through there as quickly as possible. And if I remember correctly, we were again illuminated by Iranian radars that that belong to missile firing units.
So you're always on alert?
Oh yeah, always.
So when it comes to after the first month of being in the Gulf, what were some of the key things that you started to notice dealing with weather, climate, the equipment, with the heat? Because it would be 90% humidity and maybe
48 degrees in the daytime, 38 degrees at night. And yeah, it was hot. It was very, very hot. There were a number of things. And the other thing was sand. Very, very fine sand that blew. It wasn't like it was a sandstorm. There were some of those at sea, but they were usually it would be in the wind all the time, and so we had to place filters over every intake into the ship. And I've got pictures of them. They're red. It just put sponge filters over there, and they'd be red in a day or two. So we were worried about that sort of stuff, intake into the generators and all that sort of thing, and for that stuff to get into the electronics and so on, would just be nasty. So that was a concern. Heat was a concern in the general sense of electronics don't like heat very much, and so if you couldn't keep the ship cool, generally cool-ish inside, electronics will start breaking down. All the computer systems that we had, communication systems, that's radars, all that sort of thing. So we were very conscious of that, and we had to, a little bit like the army, the old cavalry, you give the water to your horse first, and then if there's any left, you get a drink, because without your horse, you haven't got anything. Well, for us, it's with electronics, and so we had to channel the air conditioning into those places that where all the electronics were, which meant my cabin was like about 40 degrees all the time, I think. I didn't have much air conditioning up where I was. And during the time we were there, over the first couple of months, we bought a huge, used, commercial 200-ton air conditioning unit and installed it in the engine room, an extra one, so that we could increase the ship's capacity to create air conditioning. So, well, we did some unique things like that, but heat was a definite problem for the helicopter pilots too. The helicopter crews, we actually had a vest. They had an experimental vest. I forget where it came from, somewhere in Canada. But these guys would put this thing on, and then it had a little pump, and it would circulate ice water through the veins in this vest, and to keep them cool. Because flying in that helicopter, man, in 50-degree weather was just killer.
I'm surprised about the sleeping conditions, because they were really right next to each other as well when you guys slept.
Oh, yeah.
And so would that affect the crew? Did you see how it affected the crew? Because
I never did, really. Everybody seemed... I think it was because it was such a unique opportunity for everyone that none of us had done anything like this before. Our ship was being employed in a way it had never been employed before. We had all these weapon systems, to use and to maintain, and we were flying. I think we flew 278 missions in the time I was there with my helicopters. So it would act, and we were fueling a few ships every day. I mean, the activity level was terrific, and everybody, you know, liked it. I mean, you could get bored to tears if you're just boring holes in the ocean for weeks on end, every now and then, you know, coming across a merchant ship, maybe boarding them or something.
Right.
But we had all these other things that we were doing at the same time, and so I never needed to motivate anybody. Nobody ever said, oh, I've had enough of this crap, you know, like they, everybody was up for it every day. That was my, the sense that I had. And the other thing is, of course, you know, self-preservation is a tremendous motivator. And if you're at all concerned about getting your ass shot off, you really do pay attention more than if you weren't in that situation. And I think that's the thing. Everybody, you know, everybody was counting on everybody else to do everything right the way they're supposed to do it. And therefore, they had to do their own part. So motivation was never a problem.
And it was the first, right from the get-go, the first step was...
Right from the day they said we were going. It started in the dock here in Halifax, and it never stopped.
That's good.
And the interesting thing is that after we got back, you know, I commanded that ship for another couple of years, and that crew to this day, I mean, this is 15 years later, that crew has a special bond, you know, because of the things we did that nobody else had ever done. And I still, you know, if I go to Halifax for a visit, my son lives there and his family, and or out here I'm walking around and people come across the street and say, "Sir, remember me, we were together in Protector." And it's, you know, it's really something, really. Yeah. I mean, that there is a bond that is so different from any other ship I sailed in because of what we did there.
And so going to boarding... your first boarding procedure, how did that go? How did you feel about it? Did you feel confident enough that your men knew what they were doing and that they followed the procedure which the Canadian government underlined?
Yeah, well, we've had in all our ships for many years, we've had a boarding party, a group of people who are designated to do that specific job. And every ship practices that. We have done that in my entire time in the Navy. Every ship has been ready to do that. So there were a few additional wrinkles in the Persian Gulf situation because of specific rules of engagement, things you were allowed to do, things you weren't allowed to do. You were in a situation where you could, if you did the wrong things, you could actually precipitate the beginning of a shooting war.
Mm-hmm.
So none of us had been in that situation before, but we had boarded ships for practice over the years. So my, even though, and Protector always had a boarding party.
Okay.
At least, you know, on paper, we had an organization that did that. Now, it's not something that particular ship had done, because the AOR generally wouldn't. It would normally be the destroyers and frigates doing that. But these people had served in those ships too.
Mm-hmm.
So we had quite a few people with some experience level there. We were doing it in an armed fashion, but that's what we practiced anyway. So, you know, it wasn't really anything all that new. It was for real, though. That's the difference. We would take turns. We would board none of our own ships. That's what we would normally do for practice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we're actually boarding real merchant ships. And so I think probably the most challenging thing was that most of these people hadn't really been on board a merchant ship before. So just knowing, you know, how to get around to the bridge, to the engine room, to check things out, that sort of thing.
Right.
Dealing with masters that don't speak English. But we even practiced that, because if we were going to have another ship board us, I'd, you know, pretend to speak Chinese or something, just so that they've got cards with various languages on them, and until they find the right one, it's now, okay, and there's a question in English, and shows it to them, it's in his language, sort of thing.
Oh, so you didn't have translators with you then?
No, I think I had one. I think I have one guy on board who actually could speak some Arabic, but I think I only had one.
Hmm.
That's all I remember.
What was the reputation of the Protector, I guess, but if you want general Navy, Canadian Navy with the coalition, like what did you hear a lot, like from the Americans or from the British, or generally just summing it up?
Well, our Navy has always been very well thought of. I'm not bragging, I'm stating a fact. The Canadian Navy has always been thought of by our allies as a very, very professional Navy. What everybody also knew over the years was that, at least most of my career, was that we did not have the newest equipment, the newest ships, but what we had, we used it very, very well, better than most navies, and other navies will tell you that. The U.S. Navy will tell you that. We are the best ship handlers, navigators, and war fighters in terms of what we have to fight with. We, you know, we just didn't have all the good stuff, but we're a very, very well-trained Navy, and we've always had that reputation, and it was the same in the Gulf. We were thought of very highly there. And then there were some additional things that we did there that endeared us to our friends, and that was, one was having protector there in the Gulf, because none of the other ships, none of the other navies would send their supply ships into the Gulf. They wouldn't do it. And we did that. None of the other navies ever boarded a ship from a supply ship, or nobody ever did that. Nobody flew four Sea Kings off a supply ship and did all kinds of interdicting of ships and so on. No one did that. So Protector really gained a huge reputation there. She was actually nicknamed Chuck Wagon, and that's what all the Americans called us. And you know the old deal about the cattle herd sort of moving across the prairies, the cattle drives, and the Chuck Wagon was the guy that, you know, went ahead, set up camp, got all organized for the night so that when the weary drovers get there, their dinner's all ready, and you know, if they need some medical care, the guy would take care of that and do everything for them. And so that's an old American sort of tradition, and so they dubbed Protector the Chuck Wagon, and that was our, that's what everybody called us in messages. I've got all kinds of messages flying back and forth between ships saying, I'm going to see the Chuck Wagon today, or this or that or the other thing. And when we left, they sent some wonderful messages to us saying, you know, they were really thankful.
Very impressed with the professionalism. Yeah.
And then it goes beyond that, of course. I mean, Dusty Miller got given the job to run the logistics group because we had done, you know, so well with three ships there. We kept two ships on station all the time. Mm-hmm. We intercepted more ships than anybody else. We boarded more ships than anybody else. We really exceeded all their sort of fondest wishes for what we might be able to do for them. So it was a very, very positive thing for our Navy to acquit ourselves that well. But it's not that unusual. I mean, honestly, our Navy's always acquitted themselves very well.
And it had been, last one was the Korean War, last when the Navy was involved with the...
Yeah, absolutely. That was the last time we'd gone to war.
Right.
In the Navy. And I think what it proved to me was that our training system, our system for producing people at all ranks who could think on their feet, use their initiative, come up with new ideas, and perform well in a high stress situation of potential war and war. It proved to me, because we hadn't done that in my entire career, we had not done that, and so it was the proof of the pudding. Really, it was the, let's find out now if we're really as good as we think we are. You know, we think we're ready to go to war at any minute. Are we really? And it might have turned out otherwise, but it did not. And the fact that my ship's company grew to twice its size in a matter of weeks, with all those new weapons and sensors and everything that we put on board,
new people,
the ideas that came forward from my crew at every rank level, leading seamen, petty officers, officers, they would literally come forward and say, "Sir, I've got an idea. You know, like, I think we can do this a little bit better if we do this instead of that." Mm-hmm. That sort of thing was coming out all the time. The engineers came with ideas. We could rig hoses, a pipe around the top of the funnels, and run seawater continually down the funnels, which would reduce our infrared signature to the, because that one missile had an infrared homing capability. We put pipes around the upper deck, the after half of the ship, all the way, and we kept pouring seawater 24 hours a day down the ship side. Same thing, because that's where the engine room and the boiler room are, and the missile. We flew a an infrared camera around the ship in one of our helicopters and took a picture, infrared pictures of the ship, and we could see all the real big black spots were the hot spots. And we had to figure out ways to cool those down. And those were the sorts of ideas. The radar loves 90-degree angles. So if a radar beam comes in and hits a 90-degree corner like this, it's beautiful. It all goes back. So they get a really, really strong return from the ship. And if you're in an airplane and you've got one missile to fire, you're going to fire it at the biggest radar target you have, because that'll be the biggest ship. And that's probably the most expensive, valuable ship to the unit, to that group. So what could we do to make our radar signature smaller and smaller so that we started to look on radar like Terra Nova or Athabasca? Well, we found out, my guy said, we could weld pieces of steel here so that 90-degree corner doesn't exist anymore on the upper deck of the ship. So all the way through the Suez Canal, guys were up there welding sheets of steel to reduce those angles. And then we put all this radar absorbing material. It looks like a mattress kind of deal, but we had our hands on a bunch of that stuff. We actually reduced the ship's radar signature by half.
Wow.
So that's the sort of thing, you know, and that's what told me that, boy, we do have really, really well-trained people. They're coming forward with all these wonderful ideas, and every night when I went to bed, from the day we left Halifax, every night when I went to bed, for the first couple of months we were gone, when I got to bed, which wasn't only 3 or 4 hours a night, I guess, most nights, but anyway, I would lay down. The last thing I thought of every day was, okay, what haven't I thought of yet? What am I, you know, what have I missed? Because you get all this stuff going on, everything's changing, and all the training and coordinating and, you know, developing the new tactics for all these new systems and everything. 100 things going on all the time. What have we missed? What is there something that we've totally, like, not dealt with yet? And that was my last thought every night. I got 500 people here I'm trying to bring home safe, and I'm just wondering if there's something I've missed. And that was always my final thought. And so, and then I would assess where we are in terms of combat readiness, and you'd ask me about that before we started. And so, if I put a number on it, I'd say the day we left Halifax, we were 50% combat ready, because we got all this new stuff, and we don't know how to use it yet.
Mm-hmm.
It might not even be 50%. It might be less than that.
Wow.
By the time we got to Gibraltar and finished with that Exocet missile head and so on, I said, okay, you know, I think we're about 75-80%, something like that. By the time we got to the Gulf, I was a little better than that. 80-85, and then on my after my first patrol, I said, we're pretty much there. This is as good. We're probably 95%, you know, there might be a couple of little things we're still working on to make this a little better, that a little better, but this is almost as good as we can get with what we have to work with. So now we got to maintain this level. That's the thing. For the next, who knows, 18 months, we got to stay up here. We can't let anybody get to you know, overconfident or ho-hum, okay, we've been doing this for quite a while now,
yeah,
it's all the same. And that's why I fired the weapon systems every time I went to sea, to remind everybody, we're back out here. We're you know, we can be shot at any minute. So we're going to fire our guns, fire our missile protection systems, make sure everything's working. And then we're right back up. Everybody's up on standing and ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we ended up, and I, as I said to you earlier, we didn't have any trouble maintaining that. I thought I might have to, you know, jack people up a little bit once in a while. Come on, don't get lazy, let's keep going. Never had to do that. Virtually never.
It's amazing. When did you finish your tour? When did you finish with the Protector?
1992 in November, I brought her from the East Coast out here after having done some other amazing things. Actually, we did a couple of deployments in 1990 and 91 and 92 to Northern Norwegian Sea. Did some big exercises there. A couple of deployments to the Caribbean for exercises there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was the Canadian contingent commander for hurricane relief operations in Florida and the Bahamas. In 1990, what year was that? 92, after Hurricane Andrew went through, you know, the strongest hurricane ever to go through a major city, 200-mile-an-hour winds. We went down and so I took my ship and all my people, and they flew another 100 air engineers from Edmonton down, and we rebuilt schools for in South Miami, South Dade County. Kids that were not going to be able to go to school this year, we got roofs back on their schools and got them back to school. And then we went to the Bahamas and built emergency housing, Red Cross housing, for a village there that had been totally wiped out, 1,500 people. So we had to get them sheltered, and so we went and did that. I mean, things that I never would have guessed we'd be involved in. And then brought the ship through the Panama Canal up here to Victoria, and gave command to my executive officer, because the ship was going into refit then for a very long time. She'd been worked hard for 3 years, so she went into an overhaul for 2.5 years. Mm. And I flew back to Halifax the next day and took command of the Canadian Forces Warfare Center back there. So,
when were you done with the Gulf War then?
Well, we left January 10th. And the only sad thing about all this, really, in my mind, and you're going to interview Admiral George at some point, I think, aren't you?
No, I have Rear Admiral
Summers
and also Vice Admiral J.Y. Forcier.
Oh, J.Y. Forcier, right. Okay. Anyway, the only mistake I can think of that we really bad mistake we made was that a decision was taken by the maritime commander of the day to change the ship's companies at some point after 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the reason was that we didn't have the sister ship of Protector, the only other supply ship that the Navy has, was in overhaul in Halifax. So she was in the dry dock, not coming out anytime soon. So there was no replacement for the ship. Likewise, Athabascan couldn't be replaced because the other ships of her class were in a major midlife conversion sort of thing that was taking years. So there was no replacement for her. And the older one, Terra Nova, there were others like her, but she was already fitted with this stuff, so we might as well kind of leave her there. So the decision was made at some point that we would change the ship's companies in the three ships 1 month apart, starting in January of 91 with Protector, and then the next month would be one of the other two, and then the third month with the last one. And the Admiral, before we left Halifax, had said to the families that when they, you know, all the families would say, well, when are they going to be home? And he said, 6 months. So somehow that became important to him, and it wasn't important to anybody else, frankly. Hmm. But that decision was taken. But that was before the United Nations had passed the resolution that says by the 15th of January, if Saddam Hussein has not left Kuwait, we're going to throw him out physically, militarily. Mm-hmm. And once that resolution was passed by the UN, it was clear to me, and it was very clear to me because every time I would fuel a U.S. ship in December and into early January, I would talk on the sound-powered telephone to the captain on the other ship, which means there's no radiation. Nobody can pick up that conversation. That's why it's called a sound-powered phone. And he and I, we would always have a little chat, and they all told me, we're firing. You know, there's no doubt about it. January 15th or 16th, we're shooting. And so it was clear to me that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Christmas time, the Admiral came to, Admiral George came to the Gulf with a few other senior officers and dignitaries. And we were having midnight mass Christmas Eve at sea in Protector and the flight deck. And the Admiral flew on board in a helicopter, and at some point he said to me, I need to talk to you sometime before I leave. And he was only going to be there for a number of hours. And I said, okay. So we, I don't know, it was after midnight mass, 1 o'clock in the morning or something, in my cabin, and he said, okay, he said, I'm going to change your ship's company in January. And I said, sir, that's a big mistake. We're going to war in January. And he said, I don't think so. And I said, well, I talked to all the captains of these ships. I'm telling you, U.S. ships are going to war in January, about a day after that resolution date drops dead. He said, well, I gave my word to the families. And I said, they don't expect us on. I told all the families after you left that, you know, this is a movable feast. We don't know. I mean, it's a long time. It's 6 months from now. We don't know. Maybe we're going to be home earlier. Maybe not. He said, no, I gave my word. So Admiral Summers, I'm sure, will tell you that he did everything he could. And Admiral Forcier was his chief of staff. They did everything they could to convince the Navy not to do that. Mm. But they wouldn't hear of it. So we changed. On January the 10th, we flew off and handed things over to the other ship's company over a couple of... Oh, yeah, when I was talking to the Admiral that night, I said, well, sir, then, if you're going to do that, you better leave, you know, me and a handful of key people here. Because I knew what it was to get that ship where what it took.
Right.
To get us war ready, and we were war ready. And these new guys weren't. Mm-hmm. And he said, nope. And he said, I'll tell you why. Because if I make you go home, nobody else can say, well, I'm more important than the captain. So that was his plan, and that's what we did. So I changed over to the turned it over to the other captain over a period of about 2 days, and his ship's company turned over with all my people.
Right.
And we flew home on the 10th, I think it was 10th or 11th. War started on the 16th. So what did Protector do? She went out of the Gulf, because they had to work this new crew up to get them ready. So instead of us being out there going to war right now, they left for a few weeks. And the war was only a few weeks long.
Right.
And then it was over.
And did you hear from other captains that we need your ship?
Oh, yeah. All of them were shocked that this was happening, especially our other two captains, the Canadian ones. And as I said, I know how hard Admiral Summers fought to have that turned off, but he just couldn't get it done. So the Americans, when I left, the messages I got from the Americans, the Brits and so on, the Dutch, were really quite touching, actually. Mm-hmm. So the hardest thing I ever had to do was give up my ship, and then we flew home. And I was put in command of the other one, which was in the dry dock.
Yeah.
And I never actually went on board. I was the captain. I never set foot on board that ship. And they got back about 60 days later. And the day it came into harbor, I took command again. Mm-hmm. And they got off. My whole ship's company couldn't wait to get back on board our own ship. And so the day they got there, within 2 hours, they were off. And we were back. And it was a strange, strange thing. The hardest thing I ever had to do in the Navy, that's for sure.
Wow.
Weird.
My last question is there anything else that you could think of or that would be important from the Gulf War? I'm done with the questions, but is there anything you want to add?
Well, I think, as I said, for me, the end, my experience was that was really confirming that we have this tremendous resource of people, and it's no different now. I'm training young officers now, and they're every bit as good, smart, keen as I was, 40 years ago when I was in their shoes. So first off, we have, we have a good group of people to draw from in the Canadian population. Secondly, nobody has a better training system in the Navy than we do. Nobody. We spend a lot of money at it. We spend a lot of time at it. I do some teaching. I just came back from in August. I was in Japan for 3 weeks teaching U.S. naval officers, and I've done that before. And we have a British officer here on exchange, a lieutenant commander from the Royal Navy, who's the senior navigator in our little navigation group down here. And he's the fourth one that's been there since I've been here. And every one of them has told me that we have the finest trained navigators in the world. Nobody trains as well as we do. Nobody produces better bridge watchkeeping officers than we do. And I firmly believe that, but I've had other navies tell me that. Lots of them. So And so this was the proof of the pudding, as I said. We went to war with old ships that we slapped new weapon systems on overnight, literally, you know, doubled the ship's company, had to reorganize everything, and we still shone, really. And you can't do that if you don't have good people. So that's the key. I mean, even with the crappy equipment we've had most of my life, and it's better now with the kind of control frigates at the moment, but we always acquitted ourselves well as a Navy. And we did. That was the proof to me. And most people didn't get to prove it. I mean, 1952 was the last time anybody got to go and prove it, until we did. And it just shows that we're on the right road. We've got good people, and we train them well, and they will rise to the occasion. And our Army's proving exactly the same thing in Afghanistan right now. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, we didn't have all the best stuff. The Army's been neglected for a long time. And yet we have these tremendous soldiers. And now they do have good stuff to do the job with. And they're, you know, you read the praises in the paper every day from every corner of the globe about how tremendous Canadian soldiers are. That's us. We had the same response during the Second World War, the same response during the First World War, the Korean War. Canada has always, always risen to that occasion. And that's a testament to the people, you know, from whence we come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for giving me this interview.
My pleasure, John.
And,
my pleasure.
Yeah.